of the British Empire, Fellow of the Royal Society, Fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, and, well, I could just stop there, couldn't I? But somehow a person arrives at this station in life and not by a random walk. Joycelyn Brunel was born in Northern Ireland to a Quaker family and to an architect for the City Planetarium. So she has had her head in the stars from a very early age. Her early education included the Mount School in York, which is a Quaker boarding school for girls, or at least it was at that time. I don't know about now. But this is the place where she became intrigued and interested in physics through the influence of a good teacher. She received her Bachelor of Science from the University of Glasgow and her PhD from Cambridge University, where she had the distinction of discovering little green men. These were later dubbed pulsars, which, for those of you who are not astronomers or physicists, are fast-rotating neutron stars which emit radiation in pulses. And as such, these are the most reliable cosmic clocks available to observational astronomy. She also physically built a good portion of the radio telescope she was using at the time. Joycelyn has held positions at the University of Southampton, University College London, the Open University of Great Britain, the Royal Observatory at Edinburgh. She has also been a visiting professor of astronomy at Princeton and Dean of Sciences at the University of Bath. She will, in October, become president of the Institute of Physics. She holds prizes from the Franklin Institute, the Center for Theoretical Studies in Miami, the American Astronomical Society, and the American Philosophical Society, as well as numerous honorary degrees. And I am now officially out of breath. But of course, there is more to a well-rounded person than their professional life. And if one asks British friends about Joycelyn Brunel, one hears that she is on the advisory board of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, that she is an advocate for women in science. She has served on the Quaker Peace and Social Testimonies Committee of Britain Yearly Meeting and contributed to several of its publications. She has been an invited speaker for, I'm not sure whether it was London or Britain Yearly Meeting at that particular time, but there, and also at Friends General Conference. She has been an apologist in the public media for Quaker thought and practice. And she has clerked Britain Yearly Meeting and will soon become clerk of the Central Committee of the Friends World Committee for consultation. Now, somewhere in this, she also managed to raise a son. And she has a diploma in piano as well. One of the most intriguing things that I found in researching Professor Brunel is something from a website at Goddard, NASA Goddard's website, which is specifically for children. And there was a question which says, what do you think people find most surprising about you? And this is her response. I think the thing that surprises people most is that I am religious. I'm an elder in my church, which is the Quakers, or Religious Society of Friends. A lot of people think that scientists aren't religious. It's simply not true. As you can see, we are indeed very fortunate to have Joycelyn Brunel with us, and that there is probably no one on the planet more capable of addressing the topic, heavens above and heaven below. It is our practice at FAHE to enter into a time of waiting from which the speaker may speak when she is ready. And to enter us into that time of waiting, I would like to read from an old hymn, which I'm sure many of you will recognize, and which is related, I think, to the topic for this evening. The spacious firmament on high, with all the blue ethereal sky and spangled heavens a shining frame, their great original proclaim. The unwearied sun from day to day does his creator's power display and publishes to every land the work of an almighty hand. Soon as the evening shades prevail, the moon takes up the wondrous tale and nightly to the listening earth repeats the story of her birth, whilst all the stars that round her burn and all the planets in their turn confirm the tidings as they roll and spread the truth from pole to pole. And what though in silence, solemn, all move round this dark terrestrial ball? What though no real voice or sound amidst their radiance orbs be found? But in reason's ear they all rejoice and utter forth a glorious voice, forever singing as they shine, the hand that made us is divine.
That poem by Addison is on a short list. I hadn't expected to start this way, but it seems appropriate. As one of my recreations, my hobbies, I collect poetry. Poetry with an astronomical theme. Jennifer Barraclough is responsible for starting me on that trail when on one occasion at a meeting here she introduced me to a poem, Elizabeth Jennings's Delay. A project that I have on at the moment and which I really ought to be working on this weekend is as a co-editor with a poet of an anthology of poetry which will be published by the Gulbenkian Foundation just as soon as I get my finger out and do my homework. It's an anthology of about 100 poems on the theme of space and astronomy. About 20 of the poems are newly commissioned, and we haven't got them all in yet, so whether it's 20 remains to be seen. And the other 80 will be from already published material of all sorts of ages. And Addison's The Spacious Firmament on High is on my co-editor's must-have list. So it may well appear there. I chose the title Heavens Above and Heaven on Earth because, as you've heard, I'm an astronomer, so I study the heavens above. And I'm also a Quaker, one who tries to make present the kingdom of God, to bring in heaven on earth. I'm a lifelong Quaker. Indeed, I think the family's Quaker for quite a few generations back. I've belonged to Ireland Yearly Meeting, Britain Yearly Meeting, and been a sojourning member of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. I'm a professional academic scientist, not a theologian, not a philosopher, although that doesn't always stop me from going into those areas. And I've counted up that I've worked apart from the universities where I got my degrees, I've worked in 7 different universities. Princeton and 6 in the UK. The 6 in the UK are all state universities. Woodbrook apart, we don't have any Quaker colleges in Britain, and we have only 1 privately funded university. So universities here normally mean state-funded universities, with all the tensions that that results in. And because I've spent part of my life as a married woman with family commitments and followed my husband around the country, I've had what's tactfully called a portfolio career. I've done some teaching, some research, and I worked out last night, I've spent about 20 years in academic management, administration. Now, I realise that management or administration is a dirty word to some faculty members. But I have to say that I've found that it's there that there's much more scope to apply Quaker principles and misapply Quaker principles. I'm going to start by pulling out for you some of my experiences as a teacher in higher education. Officially, I'm retired. I turned 65 in a few weeks, but I still do a lot of lecturing, typically 40 or 50 lectures each year, but they're all one-off lectures. They're not part of a course, and they're all to different bodies, usually to non-astronomers. I think this is legitimately included under lecturing, teaching, because it requires good teaching to get across to such a body the nuances and the understanding of astronomy. In a few weeks, I'll be doing a lecture at the University of Bath. This will be in August, in midsummer. And the students I'll be talking to are overseas students. Note the inherent insular attitude of the Brits, overseas. We're an island. Overseas students who've come to Britain early to brush up their English before they start university courses in all sorts of subjects at every which British university in October. As well as helping them learn English in the normal sort of way, the organisers like the students to have some practice at taking notes in lectures. And so they lay on some lectures for these students, and they try and cover the whole range of academic subjects. But it's quite hard, they say, to find science topics that are accessible to such a range of students. I've been going there now for quite a few years to do a lecture about how we are all made of star stuff. I start with the origins of the universe, the Big Bang, 13 billion years ago. And I cover the subsequent 13 billion years fairly quickly to make it fit within one lecture period. I tell them how only hydrogen and helium were created then at the Big Bang, and how all the other chemical elements were created inside stars and made available through the death, often the explosive death, of those stars. And so the calcium, the carbon, the oxygen, the iron, the lithium, and so on, in our bodies, all those were formed inside stars. We are made of star stuff. So much so, we could almost claim to be stars. I don't talk about God in the lecture to these English students of English, because I don't think God has a place in a science lecture, and because I personally don't believe in a creator God. Don't want to go into that in great detail. It could take 40 minutes of its own accord. What happens almost every year, and will probably happen again this year, is at the end of the lecture, even though there's been an opportunity for questions, students will come forward and crowd round the desk. Some of them wanting to ask more questions, some of them wanting to ask questions that they didn't dare ask in public, and several of them with points to make. And there'll probably be, amongst that group milling round the desk, several bearded, slightly swarthy-skinned young men. It's always men. They're the Muslim students, or some of the Muslim students. The ones who feel I should have included a religious element, specifically the one they've signed up to. After the event, they regularly send me abbreviated versions of the Quran and other publications which prove, post hoc, that the Quran predicted modern cosmology. If we lived in a different age, it might be a different group of students that is speaking to me thus. But because of the age we are in, it's the Islamic students. And it's the very young Islamic students. It's students who have yet to really appreciate that in coming to university, at least to university in Britain, they are exposing themselves to other ways of thinking, some of which they will be quite comfortable with, and some of which will make them very uncomfortable. And they've got quite a big transition to make. I hope they make it. So a question to ponder is, how do we help the fundamentalist or otherwise very narrow student who arrives with quite strong preconceptions? How do we help them to go through this process of exposing themselves to other ways of thinking without feeling threatened? How can we make them confident enough that they can have conversations and don't feel they have to try to convert everybody to their way of thinking all the time? I haven't found a solution to this one. And I strongly suspect the same thing will happen in a few weeks' time when I speak again at the University of Bath. For many years, as you heard in the introduction, I taught at a uniquely British institution called the Open University. University that was set up about 35 years ago. It teaches mature students, adults. It teaches them at home. They study after work and at weekends. We mail out to them teaching materials, workbooks, DVDs. We put stuff on the web. They pick up assignments, do them on the web and submit them. They're typically students who left school quite early, having believed a teacher who told them they were thick. And they've gone and got jobs, and gradually they've gained confidence and come to realise, hey, you know, I'm brighter than one or two other people I work with. Maybe I'm not so thick. And with great trepidation, ultimately enrol for a university degree. They are very scared. They are very insecure, particularly in their first year. What they're doing requires a lot of courage, and they're doing it on their own. And when working with them as faculty, as teachers, and marking their work, it's extremely important that we be tactful and supportive. They also have a lot of knowledge and experience of their own. And I remember running a tutorial class, for which I guess 5 or 6 of them had turned up, all of us having driven for a couple of hours that morning to get there. And we were talking about electricity. And it turned out one of them worked in the electricity industry. And he knew a lot more about aspects of it than I did. That's just one example. The same applies over and over again. So you also have to learn to respect what the student brings to the event or the assignment or whatever. That experience has shown me how roughly in Britain, how abruptly, how crassly we treat our own undergraduate students. We shout at them. Well, not literally maybe, but you know, we bash them around. It was very interesting teaching at Princeton, private university, expensive, students paying a lot of money, students' parents paying a lot of money. And if a student shows up at your office door, you drop everything to attend to the student. And what really was telling for me was with the end of term tests. In Britain, the marks, the grades, would be typed out on a sheet and pinned up on a board for everybody to see. In Princeton, the student gets an envelope, and in that envelope is a note of their grade and a histogram showing the grades of the whole class so they can see how they've done. How much more tactful. Except the guys who come near the top of the class. They'd love it to be public. So I wonder, what's the best way to treat our students? Maybe somewhere in between, but who knows. I've always been a bit of an innovator, not in a big way, but always trying to improve the systems that I see around me, that I'm working within. And 35 years ago, in my first teaching post, I caused a certain amount of trouble. I was the first in the department to introduce student feedback questionnaires. The students were very receptive of the idea. Oh, is Dr. So-and-so going to do this? Oh, that's a shame. And I wasn't very popular at the staff meeting where I proposed, sorry, that would be faculty meeting in the US, where I proposed giving students a sheet of physics formulae along with their exam paper, so that they didn't have to memorise all these formulae. My colleagues weren't happy, but I won the argument on a temporary experimental basis. Both those practices are now standard practices. Meanwhile, the internet has arrived. Computers with facilities like Mathematica. And certainly I, for one, haven't yet fully adapted my teaching to those sort of facilities. I haven't really worked out how you teach when there is so much information available readily. But one thing undoubtedly is clear. We have to teach our students discernment. How to distinguish the reliable web page from the nutter's web page, from the web pages with a hidden agenda. And clearly we also have to teach students how to teach themselves, certainly in science, because what we teach them today will soon be out of date, and they'll have to update themselves, and they may even change jobs, change fields quite dramatically. A little bit about research life. It's Monday morning. I'm the chair of the physics department. I have a lot of things to get through that morning, but I have an open door policy. The office door stands open except when there's a confidential meeting taking place inside. And after a few minutes, one of the senior members of staff, a former chair of the department, fellow professor of physics, called Russell, appears and stands in the doorway. He's very bothered about something, clearly, really perturbed. And it fairly quickly emerges what it is. As he settles himself in the doorway and props himself up against the doorpost. At the weekend, he had discovered that he could douse for water. Now, let me just check. Is that a word that's used in the US? You're familiar. Right. You know, with maybe a hazel rod or maybe a wire coat hanger or, yep. He had discovered he could douse for water. And he was extremely upset, I have to say. Physicists like proof. And here he had something approaching proof. Okay, albeit a bit subjective and a single sample and all that, but personal experience is fairly convincing. But physicists actually cheat. In addition to requiring proof of something, they also like to know what the mechanism is, how the heck it could happen. And physicists know of no physical force or mechanism to explain dowsing. Russell's a guy who sees things fairly black and white and needs them fairly neatly sewn up. And he was having trouble coping with this new information. He spent a long time ostensibly talking to me, but actually talking at me and to himself, trying to work out what was going on. And after an hour and a half, he finally unstuck himself from my office doorpost, having convinced himself, at least temporarily, probably only temporarily, that his subconscious must have noticed that there was a slight depression running across the field. And as he walked across this depression, his subconscious will have said, now's the time for the thing to twitch, so it did. And at least temporarily he was happy. I can't imagine that state lasted, but I didn't hear more about it. I have to say, I'm much more comfortable than the likes of Russ with saying, I don't know. And living with, I don't know. Living with the provisional. Living with shades of grey. But there are a number of my colleagues who can't handle that, I have to admit. One of the advices that we use in Britain Yearly Meeting amongst Quakers is to be open to new light from whatever quarter it may come. And yeah, although sometimes that can be very hard. And I have another question for you to think on, ponder on. How would you feel if you discovered you could douse? Maybe some of you know you can. I've never actually tried, and I haven't rushed towards that opportunity. I found that being a Quaker, at least in Britain Yearly Meeting, and being a research scientist, the two fit together pretty comfortably. St- stepping back from Quakerism a moment to a slightly more general position, I want just to say a little bit about authority. I'll talk about authority in matters of religion, and shortly, authority in matters of science. I suspect it's fairly widely agreed that religious faiths, denominations, sects, what have you, can get their authority from one or several places. The possible places are the holy writings of that faith or denomination or sect. Bible, Quran, Torah. This breaks down as it does in South Africa, where there's oral tradition, not written, but you get the feel of it. Another possible source of authority is the history, the tradition of that denomination, faith, sect. Often particularly the words of the founder. And the third possible source of authority goes under the title of continuing revelation. God speaking to us today, to put it in slightly more Quakerly language. And friends, in Britain Yearly Meeting are unusual in this country in that we put a lot of emphasis on the third, the continuing revelation, God speaking to us today. And we put much less emphasis on the Bible or on Quaker history and what George Fox said. That suits the research scientist, because as a liberal, freewheeling, footloose Quaker in Britain, what I am expected to do is to evolve my understanding, evolve my beliefs in the light of experience that I gain as I go through life. So you have a picture of what God wants for you in the world today. You go through life, you have sundry experiences, you modify that picture and you travel on. The research scientist, you probably know, develops a model, a hypothesis of, in my case, what that star system up there is doing, and saying, well, if that star system up there is doing that, then it should show da-da-da-da-da-da. And I can test da-da-da-da-da-da if I get time on such and such a telescope with such and such a piece of equipment. So sooner or later I get the telescope time, I get fair weather, I make the observations, and instead of showing da-da-da-da-da, it shows ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. I don't have to revise my picture. So I work on revising my hypothesis, come up with a new one, which says, if this new hypothesis is right, that star will show ha ha ha, but not ha 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 ha. So repeat the process. And just as in Quakerism, you revise your understanding, your beliefs, as a result of experience, so the research scientist evolves their picture in the light of experiment. And the two processes are very similar. And I suspect that's why Quakerism, at least in my version, is particularly good for research scientists. And in Britain Yearly Meeting, there's been a disproportionately large number of research scientists in our membership. One of the other things I do, besides sort of straight research, which I don't do now anymore anyway, is I promote science, I support science, by doing a lot of outside lectures, as I've mentioned. And I also provide a critical commentary on scientific process. And I do that from the perspective of a minority. You'll see shortly what the minority is. I've tried to articulate science as she really is. Believe it or not, we all do science in a cultural context, from a cultural context, each of us with quite a lot of baggage and background. And our cultural context is Western. Indeed, it's probably fair to say US dominated. It's Northern Hemisphere. It's male. It's English speaking. And it probably places ultimate authority on the data. But because of our cultural context and our background, we are not totally objective. We do try to be, but we're not. And predetermined desires, I want my pet theory to be right. Preconceived ideas or misunderstandings, and other people's results can all influence how we see our data. I have a nice example of this which is not from science, so I think everybody can appreciate it. I've got some figures coming up. Not many, but just concentrate a moment. Between 1909 and 1951, so a period of 30 years-ish, the number of Rembrandt paintings recorded as having entered the USA was 9,483. Preconceived ideas may be dominating. Astronomy is an observational science. It's a bit harder to do than mainstream physics, where you can go and twiddle a knob on something and see how it behaves. You can't go to the star and twiddle a knob. I wonder if this is the right way to go at the moment. Sorry, just having second thoughts. Yes, I think I will go on. Because we're an observational science, it's quite hard to prove something right. But what we can do, as I demonstrated with how I observe my system of stars and make predictions, you can prove things wrong. And that's normally the way my field of science proceeds. But proving something wrong gives it a rather negative ambiance. And I think that influences us, in perhaps not even a subtle way. Some of us, and Don probably knows some of them too, really glee in slicing somebody else's hypothesis model to small pieces. They are zealous at it, and far more zealous than they need be. I do wish that in some way, I don't think it's possible, but I wish that in some way we could balance this negative ambiance with something more positive. But I think that's where we're stuck. What actually happens, I judge, in an observational science is that pet star up there, pair of stars, Cygnus X1. One of the components of Cygnus X1 might be a black hole. Shocking suggestion. Try and prove it wrong. First attempt fails. Second attempt fails. Third attempt fails. 99th attempt fails. And after about 20 years, the community more or less gives up and says, oh, well, I suppose it is a black hole. The community. The community is involved in judgment, discernment. It's a very human activity, as we know as Quakers. And where you have that kind of activity going on, the community is also vulnerable to fashion and bandwagons and subjectivity. At one point, 30, 40 years ago, I was one of the editors of a journal, an astronomical journal, called The Observatory. It had the largest circulation in Britain. And people would send us manuscripts, and mostly we published them. But there was one guy who kept sending us publications saying, there's water on Mars. There's water on Mars. And we all knew there wasn't water on Mars, so we bounced his papers. Sent them back to him. Sorry, can't publish. There's water on Mars! If you treat somebody as a nut, they quite often become nuttish. Well, we now know that there's certainly frozen water on Mars, and there's evidence of liquids having flowed on Mars. But we, the editors, knew that there wasn't water on Mars, so we wouldn't publish his paper. There was a British cosmologist called Fred Hoyle, whom some of you may well have heard of, a Yorkshireman, given to fairly blunt speaking in a Yorkshire accent, but actually an absolutely brilliant scientist. And he performed an interesting role in our community, and I think a vital role. He didn't go so far as to say, there's water on Mars, but he'd say slightly more quietly, what's the evidence? And sometimes that was an embarrassing question. People did not love him for it, but they recognised his brilliance. He challenged all sorts of our fashions and bandwagons, and he provided an important corrective in the process. He probably got treated rather roughly by the community. Maybe if he hadn't been a Yorkshireman, that would have been less so, but I'm not sure about that. So where does authority in science lie? How is it decided what's right? Maybe authority lies with the data. That's the safe, quick answer. Except the data is sometimes a bit ambiguous. And I think authority also lies with one's peer community, one's colleagues. And I think authority also lies with those who control access to funds and publication and recognition. I find it disappointing that a number of my colleagues won't accept this kind of thinking. Of course we're objective, we're good scientists. End of discussion. Does my science impact on my religion? Does my religion impact on my science? Yes, ethics and morality, the way I approach things, I think probably have a bit of a Quaker stamp. But beyond that, I think my religion does not impact on my science. Does my science impact on my religion? 51 years ago, the Sputnik satellite was launched. It was an enormous shock to people in Britain, and I think also in the US, because we all assumed that we were more technically advanced than the Soviets, and here the Soviets go and launch a satellite, something we couldn't do. I was age 14 at the time, and already showing that I was good at science. In Britain, there was suddenly tremendous emphasis on science, and any kid who could do science was encouraged to do science. And I probably would have done science anyway, but that's part of my background. So I've been developing as a scientist really ever since we started learning science in school, which in my case was at the beginning of high school. And I've been Quaker all my life. My Quakerism and my science are comfortable bedfellows. They've lived together for 50, 60 years. But if I stop and look at the shape of those bedfellows, I find that the science bedfellow is still very much in its recognisable shape. It's the Quaker shape that has moulded itself around the science. And I hold some beliefs that I think some people would consider quite outrageous. I'm not going to go into that now because it would take too long. Happy to talk with people offline. But the comment I want to make at this point is, in this respect, my Quakerism has been largely unchecked. There are not people around that I can dialogue with in Britain Yearly Meeting on these kinds of faith and science issues. I don't know whether that's me saying simply that I'm weak on Quaker theology, or whether I'm saying that Quaker theology is weak in Britain. But one bit of me thinks they've had too much free rein in that respect. And then to move finally on to management, admin, and other more general areas. As I said at the beginning, it's when I've had management roles of considerable responsibility, that there's actually been more scope for applying Quaker principles, Quaker values. And I think the area where I have been able to do most is on gender issues. I know that women in science, engineering, technology, maths, medicine is an issue in the US as well as in the UK. I think the US's thinking is just marginally ahead of the British. I'm one of very few senior women in physics. When I become president of the Institute of Physics in October, I shall be its first female president. The US has already had a female president of, not sure whether it's AIP or APS, but Mildred Dresselhaus has been there before me. When I became a full professor, which doesn't quite translate across the Atlantic, and chair of a physics department, I doubled the number of females in Britain who were in that position. When I was an undergraduate, excuse me, I was the only female in a class of 50. Someone here. And I've had a fairly rough ride, I have to say. It's not been straightforward. And I'm keen that younger women have it more easy. I find myself called on to be a representative of women, a spokeswoman for women, an interpreter or advocate for women, as well as if I stand back a bit as well, as well as being a role model and a mentor. And it's quite hard work in Britain. There isn't a lot of direct malicious discrimination goes on, but there's a lot of indirect unthinkingness. The subject has been male dominated forever, and it's a little bit hard to get it shifted from that. There's no excuse these days for unthinkingness, except some academics are such brilliant researchers they can't possibly take time to attend a training course on gender or diversity or fair recruitment or fair promotion or unconscious bias or anything. And I recognise that it is very hard for the majority to hold for the majority that holds power to see that they hold power. And that's what I'm trying to communicate, often as a lone voice, and not always a very popular voice. A couple of other small points. One of my toughest jobs was when I worked for a boss, a woman, who lied like a trooper. She'd say one thing to your face, and the next time she saw you, she'd say the exact opposite. I suspect she wasn't totally in control, and her way of keeping control was to be utterly fickle, so her staff never knew what to expect when they went in to see her. It was tricky. I learnt, after each meeting, to send her a note saying, "At our meeting today, we discussed this and this, and I understand, or my understanding is, that we agreed, blah, blah, blah. If I've misunderstood you, could you please let me know within 24 hours? Otherwise, I'm proceeding on this assumption." And that curtailed her a bit. But she didn't love me for it. And one other occasion, working in the same place, I was chair of the faculty board, and faculty board very clearly came to a decision that I knew would not be appreciated up aloft. The tradition in many bodies is that the minutes get written up and presented at the next meeting. I decided this was such a hot potato that we'd do the minute then and get it agreed. So I explained the Quaker business method to my slightly bemused science professors, sent them off for a tea break, while the committee secretary and I composed the minute. And when the rest of the university realised how we'd done it, there were big grins all round. And the board itself was very happy with the way it had worked. She wasn't. But it faithfully recorded the decision of the board, and I was under no pressure to rewrite the minutes, which I would have been otherwise. So to round up this ramble, I had the opportunity to read the Harvard Alumni magazine recently, and from this picked up an interesting snippet. In French, there's no exact equivalent of our word leadership. For the French, leadership means pedagogy. Leaders are those who can explain the world, who can explain the situation to the people in a way that they can understand. They're the people who help others see what's going on. They make folk feel they understand, they're taken seriously, and they're worth being helped to understand. It sounds to me like discernment and communication are the skills of a leader and a pedagogue. And that's my final point for you to ponder over this weekend. Thank you. Opportunity for comments, reactions, questions, remarks, nothing.
Yes, I'd like to return to your remarks about fundamentalism, and I wondered if you had read Helen Armstrong's arguments, especially in her book The Battle for God.
Karen Armstrong.
Karen
Armstrong, yes.
Because she argues, I found it quite convincing, that in each of the three Abrahamic religions, there has been a rise of fundamentalism in reaction to secularism.
Yes.
Yeah. And therefore, one would think that, and that therefore the battle for God is not between the different Abrahamic religions, but rather within each, between the fundamentalists and the liberals who are wandering off into secularism. So I wondered what your thought was on all that. Did that seem like a reasonable argument about for the origins of fundamentalism.
Right. First of all, can people at the back hear okay when people at the front ask questions? Good. Okay. I'm a great admirer of Carol. Not entirely. Okay, so maybe when people ask questions in the future, you need to stand up and, if you're near the front, turn around, but at least keep your voice up. Caroline was asking about the writings of Karen Armstrong, particularly The Battle for God, where Karen Armstrong says that the rise of fundamentalism is in response to secularism. Am I paraphrasing you correctly? Right. I very much like Karen Armstrong's writings, though they're coming out a bit thick and fast these days, so we'll see. And I have that book, and I've read a large chunk of it. I found it such an exciting book, I have to keep stopping and thinking about it. So I haven't got through it yet. But I think what she's arguing, yeah, is sensible. I think we can... I think she is reflecting well on what's going on around us in the world. I think she's probably right. I'm not sure how that helps me deal with the Islamic students who approach me at the end of my lecture, but I think that's probably true. Pam.
Pam Lund, Woodbrook. I want to pick up something that relates to Caroline's question and relates to something else you said. I'm a mathematician originally, actually in the same Cambridge college that Justin went through a few years behind him. And I've been on the receiving end of questions about, you know, do you do X or feel X or respond as X because you're a mathematician? Mm-hmm. And I always feel that the answer is, no, I'm a mathematician because I'm this sort of person. And I feel or respond to that because I'm also this sort of person. Mm-hmm. They aren't the causal connection mm-hmm. on each other. They're both outworkings of who I am. And when you talked about the shape of your Quakerism and the shape of yourself as a scientist, I was thinking about, well, my Quakerism is as it is because I'm who I am. And the fact that I was a mathematician and that now I'm not, so to speak, I mean, I'm not a professional mathematician, although I retain that mental approach. But they are, rather than seeing them as bedfellows, I see them as both being aspects of me. And I think, well, that's perfectly reasonable, and my Quakerism is like this, and I'm a mathematician and scientist, and that will fit. Where it relates to the fundamentalism is that I then recall that in my undergraduate days, which was in the late 1960s, the equivalent, I mean, fundamentalism wasn't much used as a term then, but there was a university Christian society called the Christian Union, which was very biblically fundamentalist, actually. And most of the people who obediently trotted off to Christian Union Bible studies, ostentatiously on a Saturday evening with their Bibles under their arms, pointing out that they were going to Bible study and not to some frivolous Saturday night entertainment, were in the vast majority scientists. They were mostly in the, what you might call the hard side, physicists, mathematicians, engineers. The vast majority of the Christian Union Society at that time. And I find that so much doesn't fit with my own sense of how this is who I am, and I'm a mathematician and scientist, and this is who I am, and this is how my Quakerism is. And presumably they would say, I don't know, something analogous. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. Sorry, it's a long way around the question, but it kind of links those two bits together.
The only thought link that I can see is to do with this sort of black and whiteness. I think part of why I became a physicist is as a teenager I was extremely gauche, lacking in confidence, and physics seemed safe. You were right or you were wrong, you could do it or you couldn't do it. And there was none of this grey stuff and none of this messy stuff like people. And I actually suspect that quite a few academic physicists have come that route. Some of them are still there. Is it fair to say that the more biblical fundamentalist is also somebody who likes the answers pat? The answer to this is this, the answer to this is this, the answer to this is that. I don't know. And of course the students you were mixing with were Cambridge undergraduates, so they were extremely bright, which is just a side observation. Interesting one.
I also work for the Open University, an institution for which I have passionate affection. I think it's a wonderful institution, and I have noticed in recent years that increasingly we have younger students who leave school and who often, because they have to work or can't afford fees, are working and then doing their studies part-time evenings, which is a tremendous undertaking. I teach history, I teach religion in history, and I find some of the most able, most open-minded students, the ones who are most prepared to consider the evidence in an open-minded way and to test it as objectively as possible, are the Muslim students.
Yeah, good.
But there is an exception. They are all, without exception, young women. And I think it links to things that you're saying about also about gender, and also about treating students with respect and giving them an environment in which they can feel confident that they are being respected and treated respectfully. And I think they feel that they are able to speak and say things and to think about things in a way that maybe they haven't been up to all that time. So I kind of take heart from that.
Yes.
And while we're on the issue of gender, men here are also allowed to ask questions.
I'm Jim Anderson. I was interested in your discussion of authority and the phrase continuing revelation.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you experienced the meaning of that term and how it might differ from the term discovery, whether you feel that the universe in some way acts as a revealing entity. Is there any distinction between that sense of continuing revelation and the act of discovery by scientists?
I think that's taking me into territory where I'm not comfortable going. Not because it's an intellectual problem, but because at one level I too want to see the science, the universe, as separate. And okay, it's there and there are things we can discover about it, but I don't want to say that the act of discovery, I'm losing it slightly. I don't want to say that the universe reveals itself. I don't want to give it animation, I think is what I'm saying. That's a step too far for me, which is interesting. But the back, sir.
My name is Dan Salinas, and just going back to the fundamentals, I know we've spent a lot of time on it, but it's interested in the juxtaposition between what you're talking about in a science that is based on continuing revelation and fundamentalists who go back to the more authoritative holy text and the history and tradition of their faith. And if that, then maybe the fact that it's your topic that you're talking about and the way it's talked about that is causing them to come up to you afterwards and say these things. And I'd be interested to know if you've talked to any of your other colleagues who've gone through this process and if they're coming up with the same issues that you're coming up with you know, somebody who may be in something that's less based on a continual revelation in the field itself.
I haven't actually had opportunity to talk with other people who lecture on that course. I'm very much doing it as a one-off. I drop in for that morning and disappear again. The course organisers, of course, have seen this both in the tutorials that they hold with the students, and also have seen this cropping up year after year. And they remark that they have problems with some students' attitude to authority, and they consider that their students' attitude to authority is not appropriate for a student who's come to university, that it's too reverential. Which is partly why I said they were very young students. I mean, they are. They're at the beginning of their university careers. Let's go over this slide.
Helene Pollock from Haverford College. I was struck by your use of the word outrageous. You said, I have some outrageous beliefs. And that seems to imply that someone would be outraged.
Yes.
I kind of doubt that many of us would be, at least the people that I know here, because I think we love to play with that openness. Mm. So I wonder, rather than ask you to say those outrageous beliefs, if you might want to say something about some of the questions that you've been chewing on. And maybe your direction is outrageous and maybe it isn't, and maybe it really doesn't matter. But I am interested in knowing some of those questions.
Okay. Let me take just a couple of minutes to outline my theology. Always stressing that, you know, my theology is open to revision as life goes on and I learn things. I'm going to start actually not with science, but with the problem of suffering. We suffer. Innocent people suffer. Accidents happen. If God is a loving God and God is in control of the world, why do these dreadful things happen? You go to a typical church bookshop, you can pick up leaflets, booklets, and read about suffering. And there's a whole lot of explanations of suffering, most of which require a God for whom the ends justify the means. And I don't buy them. I don't buy any of those explanations for suffering. Now, if a scientist finds themselves painted into a corner, like I think the church is, they'll stop and they'll check out their starting assumptions. The starting assumptions were, there's a loving God and God's in control of the world. Supposing we let go of one or both of those, the problem of suffering goes away. I haven't the guts, the courage to let go of the idea of a loving God. But I have been playing with the idea that God is not in control of the world. So you don't pray to God for fine weather for commencement day. You don't blame God for any of the problems, and equally you don't thank God for any of the things. You know, if the weather turns out fine, okay, you say thank God, but you know, you don't thank God. So that's the first bit of outrageous theology. God's not in control of the world, whether that's because God chooses not to, whether God cannot, whether there is evil, which is, you know, just about balancing out God, I don't know, but God's not in control of the world. Then the other bit of God's job description that I've hacked away at is God as prime creator. As an astronomer, I know that we don't have complete understanding of the evolution, the birth and evolution of the universe. But we understand vast tracts of it. There are still some gaps, but I learn from the problems there were in the Middle Ages, when if there were gaps in processes, faithful people say, God did that. Then their scientific understanding grew from both sides. The gap closed and God was out of a job. So I'm very suspicious of putting God into the gaps we don't understand. And I actually see the start, you know, who set off the Big Bang, that kind of question. I actually see that as being closely analogous to a God of the gaps issue. And so I don't put God in there either. So my God is not a creator God and is not in control of the world, but is a loving God and can influence the world through us and can inspire, inspiration. We discuss it in more detail in the gaps, over meals, whatever, if you wish. Yes?
David Ross from Bryn Mawr, I want to bring you back to the fundamentalist.
Oh, yes.
Because I appreciate some help with a conversation I find myself in that needs me uncomfortable. Making our campuses more diverse, including underrepresented groups, is a big theme, I think, in almost all of them.
Yes.
And I pointed out that one of the big missing elements in my institution are fundamentalists. And I don't mean that just in a religious sense, but also in sort of a political sense, for want of a better phrase. That is, I don't see many of my neighbors at Bryn Mawr, and I mean that in a general sense in terms of the views that they espouse. And as I confronted or discussed this, I should say, with colleagues, they've come back and said, well, to really come into our community and be part of a liberal college, you have to buy into, for example, the idea of falsification, that something can be, that we can agree that the data can prove or disprove something. But if that's true, then it seems to me we are necessarily going to exclude a very large portion of the population from our communities, so we can't really say we want to be a truly inclusive community. So help me with that dilemma that I'm feeling, and the nagging worry in the back of my head that, well, is it just dueling fundamentalism?
Yeah.
Is my community being fundamentalist? And one of the manifestations in the States is that none of my colleagues could understand how Barack Obama could possibly lose election. Yet they lost in Pennsylvania, and I know all of my neighbors are going to vote against him. So it's like this disconnect that we're in a are we in fact in a fundamentalist vote? I don't know if there's a coherent question in there, but I think
it may be an issue of perspective, but I don't think. Guessing at the people I'm standing in front of, I don't think we are in a fundamentalist stance in any caste. But certainly there are fundamentalists, dogmatists, in some of our universities. I'm currently in Oxford University, and there's a gentleman there called Richard Dawkins. He's about as fundamentalist and dogmatic as they come. And yet he's in a university. There aren't too many like him, I have to say. But yes, you can probably think of people a bit like that in your own institutions or neighbouring institutions. Well, then there's another question that sprung to mind as you were speaking. Where does fundamentalist youth go for its higher education? I know in some places higher education is learn this, learn this, learn this. And this, this, and this is just at a higher level than you learnt in high school. And actually is no more inquiring or stretching or opening. I don't know. It's an issue actually we probably need to get our heads round, given the growth of fundamentalism in many areas of the world. We need to write one more, or okay, last one, sir.
Paul Anderson, George Fox University. Thank you for your good work. I teach Bible, and I think that the questions that you're describing about human suffering and God, enable God, those are questions also the biblical writers were facing.
Yes.
They were engaging those issues.
Yes.
So I would see that your questions are not against Scripture, but they are really going to the heart of what Scripture talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I think that we're invited into that conversation to try to understand how people in years past and also the different cosmologies are trying to deal with both some ideal convictions, but then the given realities that we face. And the direction that you mentioned, which I think is the correct one, what role are we to play as actors and partners with God in making things more like the kingdom?
That's a great note to end on. Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Very good.
Thank you very much, Jocelyn.